Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Darren McDonald, and this episode is brought to you by Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast and midday bites. No prep, no mess meals. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. Flexible for your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you could pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Sign up and save. Factor is less expensive than takeout. Head to go.factor75.com/pages/influencer and use the code TRADERUMORS2024 to get 50% off your first box while subscription is active. That is code TRADERUMORS2024 at go.factor75.com/pages/influencer to get 50% off your first box while subscription is active. Okay, so joining me for a three-peat, third week in a row, Steve Adams. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, it's going good. I am not feeling as under the weather and sick and full of coughs and generally terrible sounds as last week. So to the listener who emailed in to check if one of us had asthma or if we're just doing okay, I'm doing better now. So that was, I appreciate the concern. We had a good, Darren and I had a good good laugh at that. But sound better this week. It was, yeah. It's nice to know that people care. So
people out there caring about your health.
Or they're just like poking, mocking ruthless fun at me. And the joke went totally over my head. And that's okay too. Like, we enjoyed it. So, hey.
Either way, we appreciate the engagement from the listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Steve, baseball is back.
I noticed.
We got errors, we got pitching changes, we got box. They're all back. So it's all happening.
We got no hitters.
We got a no hitter. That was exciting.
Yeah. Ronel Blanco.
Especially because, it was this like guy who, he debuted at like age 28 or something like that. Yeah. Like
Has anyone had like a better last like 2 weeks than Ronel Blanco? I saw the Astros beat kind of saying like, him and his wife had a baby girl, and then like he had to like leave the hospital to go like make his final spring start, and he struck out like I don't know with like 10 guys in 4 innings or something, came into the dugout, got told he won a rotation spot, and then like a week and a half later he's throwing a no-hitter. Like, I mean,
that is
a good couple of weeks. So good for Ronel Blanco. That's awesome.
Yes, that is awesome. Good for him. So let's talk what's in the headlines over the past week. The biggest contract type news was that the Dodgers, they already stole all the headlines all offseason long, decided to get one more in there just before. I mean, they had already started their season in Korea, but just before the stateside opening day, got another big contract on the books. Catcher Will Smith and the club agreed to a deal. It was announced as a 10-year deal. But he already had a salary for 2024, so it was 9 years and $131.45 million in new money. What do you think about this deal, Steve?
I saw there's a lot of reactions saying, 10 years, oh my God, like, and understandably so. A lot of people tend to focus if there's some kind of like crazy outlier number there. Saw a lot of like, whoa, 10 years on a lot of only $14 million a year, like, what a steal. To me, it's just one of those cases where the Dodgers controlled Smith through the end of the 2025 season, and it seems like they probably just sat down at the table together, the proverbial table, and said, what's it going to cost us to basically buy out the remainder of your career or the remainder of your reasonable prime? I think it's interesting if you look and take, he was making I think 8.5 or 8.55 in his second to last arbitration season. So you assume that, the 2025 season, if he had gone, just through the ARB process, maybe he ends up around $12 million, $13 million, somewhere in that general range. And if you take that off of the 131 in new money, it kind of feels like you looked at, okay, what did JT Realmuto get in free agency last time around? And it was, I think, you know, like $115.5 million over 5 years. And I don't personally think it's probably all that coincidental that like the free agent portion of Smith's contract is going to come in just a couple million dollars ahead of that. I would imagine that played a significant factor. And it's like, let's get to the dollar number that you want. And the dollar number that you want for your free agent years is going to be, you want to be north of Realmuto, who had set the AAV record for catchers. And he, you know, comes in north of that, and they spread it out as teams have done increasingly over the past few years, especially big market clubs spread it out over a longer period to kind of weigh down the average annual value for luxury tax purposes. And in that sense, you know, it works out nicely for the team. I think the Dodgers probably won't be super excited about paying, you know, like a 37-year-old or whatever, Wilson, or 38-year-old, whatever it is, Will Smith, you know, $14 million that year. But with the deferrals and everything that are in there, and you just kind of look at those as necessary evils and, you know, necessary costs to get him at an affordable rate during his prime years without like really further ratcheting up your luxury tax bill. So yeah, it works out nicely for both sides.
Yeah, the Dodgers just keep adding to that deferral pile. So, yeah. I mean, I think from what I understand from the accounting, it's not really going to be a big deal because they just kind of throw the money in the bank account now and let it collect interest and stuff. But there is a strange version of the, like, you know, every year people love to talk about the Bobby Bonilla contract of him getting another $1 million from the Mets. There's going to be a more bizarre one coming up about 20 years from now where the Dodgers are paying millions of dollars to like Ohtani and Betts and Will Smith, who will all have long been retired by the time.
Freeman's got some deferrals in there. So yeah, it's going to be wild.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it seems to me like a great deal for the Dodgers in the sense that, with the deferrals, I don't think they're ever paying him even like $9 million a year because his highest
actual present day.
Because his highest salary is 13.55, I think. I'm looking at it now, and then it goes to 13 for a while, and then it goes to 9.5, and then it goes to 9.95. But $5 million is deferred annually, so that 13.55 means that the club is only going to actually be paying him 8.55 at the time, and then they'll pay him $5 million later. So in baseball salary terms, that's nothing. And Will Smith is a very good catcher.
Yeah.
Underrated. I mean, I don't know about underrated, but like quiet, like.
Yeah, maybe quiet, but I don't think he's underrated anymore. I think people, you know, like he's hitting cleanup in the Dodger lineup behind, you know, Freeman and Betts and Ohtani.
Well, maybe I shouldn't say underrated, but I think that because he's not the big star on the team, it's easy for some people to forget how good he is in the middle of that lineup.
I do agree. Like with all the star power they have there, and you just kind of have him kind of quietly tucked into the middle of that lineup. But I mean, really, really good player. I think it's interesting too, the Dodgers, some of their better prospects, you know, Dalton Rushing and Diego Cartaya are also catchers now. And it's, I mean, maybe you have a situation where like you do a timeshare behind the plate with those guys, one of those two and Smith, and Smith's mixes in at, you know, first base on if there's an injury to Freeman or he needs a day off or whatever. But like with Freeman at first and with Ohtani at designated hitter, they don't really have, you know, anywhere right now or for the foreseeable future for him to play besides catcher. Mm-hmm. And so like it does kind of open up the question of like, all right, well, hey, you know, what do you do now with Dalton Rushing and with Diego Cartaya? Do those two become, you know, interesting trade chips as the Dodgers, you know, whether it's this deadline, next offseason, whenever. And that is always exciting and fun to keep track of as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. Okay, so a great deal for the Dodgers. They're set at catcher for a long time. Perhaps the other most notable deal on the hot stove this week, you know, obviously the hot stove is cooling off now that the season is getting going. Yeah. And, you know, we saw all the big name, you know, all the big names kind of were done because of the Montgomery deal happening as we were recording the last episode.
Yeah.
So the biggest free agent deal this week, I think, is the White Sox bringing back Mike Clevinger for $3 million with another $3 million in incentives. Thoughts, feelings on this one, Steve?
Yeah, it's a really nice price for the White Sox, obviously. I'm surprised it got to that point. Just because I there have obviously been, you know, off-field issues with Clevinger. He had, you know, go back to when he was with Cleveland, and him and Zach Plesac, you know, broke the COVID protocols or whatever, and kind of put the whole team in jeopardy of all these like postponements and everything. And to say nothing of the actual, like, you know, health implications of it, like that was, didn't sit well with the team, understandably. And, you know, last spring, he had the domestic violence allegations against him, and nothing came of those in terms of discipline and everything. But I think you have to like assume that that kind of factored in somewhat to his market or lack thereof, in terms of some teams wanting to just like stay away. But, you know, he wasn't disciplined. So I think we kind of just, you know, set that aside and assume, you know, the best, I suppose. And in terms of on-field performance, he had a pretty solid year last year. His probably his best season since before he had Tommy John surgery with as a member of the Padres. And so it's nice for a White Sox team that could obviously use some pitching depth. You know, they know him well. He knows the guys in that clubhouse and everything. So it's nice for them. You know, I think last year it'll be interesting to see you know, potential trade market for him this time around. Last year he was kind of in the middle of this like decent year, but had a fair bit of money left on his deal plus a really hefty buyout on the option at the end of that year. I think he had like a $4 million buyout on his 2024 option that a new team would have been responsible for. And so I think like the money remaining on his deal kind of really worked against him. And I don't think that'll be the case this time around. So he is somebody who, you know, probably isn't going to fetch some franchise altering haul for them at the deadline. But the terms of this contract, as opposed to the terms of last year's contract, probably work more in the White Sox favor. And I think it's safe to, you know, I think most people assume that they're going to be looking to do some selling at the deadline this year after the off season that they had and the expectations that they just kind of rolled into the season with.
Yeah. I mean, I'm there's no way to know from the outside looking in how much those off field stuff, the off field things impacted, but I imagine, you know, it probably didn't help also that the market was slow and he was one of many guys just sort of sitting there over the past few months. So it's sort of like with him and Lorenzen and Montgomery still unsigned, you know, it doesn't seem like anybody was really super eager to get him either due to the market conditions or due to his reputation. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, the Sox, they need people to eat innings. And I think basically everybody that they have currently in their rotation is a viable trade candidate, even though they've already traded away a lot of stuff, because Soroka's an impending free agent, Flexen as well. Eric Fetty, he is on a 2-year deal, but I would imagine if he's pitching well, they would flip him because, you know, they signed him as sort of like an uncertain, unproven thing because he was coming off this great season in the KBO but hadn't proven himself at the major league level yet. But if he does have a few good months, then somebody will look at that contract as having surplus value and probably want to grab him. And then Crochet, I mean, he's sort of a tricky one because he has 2 more years of control after this. Like, he's set to be a free agent after 2026. So if he's throwing well, the White Sox might think, hey, you know, we might not be contending by the end of 2026, so we should trade him. But it's also, I think he's got to hit an innings limit at some point this year because he's never thrown more than like 70 innings in a season. And so who knows how many bullets he'll have left in the chamber by the time the trade deadline rolls around. But
right. He's a tough one to value, too, because like he's really just getting his first. I mean, not really just, he's literally just getting his first, you know, run in the rotation in the big leagues. And I mean, you look at his first 2 starts are just lights out, like ace caliber, just like dominance. And so if you're the White Sox, it'll be an interesting position for them, because teams will be calling about him left and right, I'm sure. And you'll be getting probably some crazy offers for 2.5 years of an arm with that kind of talent. But it's not an insignificant amount of time that they control him for, you know, 3 more years. And you don't see a lot of guys traded at the deadline with 2.5 years, certainly starting pitchers with 2.5 years of club control left. And I feel like he's somebody who, even if they carry him into the next offseason, and decide, you know, hey, we want to try to extend this guy rather than trade him. Even if they carry him into next offseason, can't get an extension done, you're still looking at marketing 2 years of control over him, or even at the 25 deadline, a year and a half of control. It's still a really compelling trade candidate. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of navigate that when the deadline approaches, because I imagine if he continues pitching the way that he has early on, which again, small sample and everything, but this is a former, you know, top 15 draft pick who basically just like skipped the minors and went straight to the majors. Like, it's a big time arm. If he really kind of starts establishing himself as that viable starting pitcher, they're going to hear some crazy things for him. And it's also going to be tempting to say, hey man, this guy's only 24. Like, what if we, you know, lock him up and kind of build around him as well, and put him and Luis Robert as kind of, you know, long-term core pieces. There's something to that as well. So that's a lot of, you know, putting the cart before the horse right now. We need to see if he actually holds up, stays healthy, and continues pitching at the level that he's at.
Yeah, for sure. But the main thing with the White Sox is that right now, if guys are pitching well, they might end up getting traded. And if they're not pitching well, then you might want to replace them. So getting Clevinger or other guys who can just take the ball, there's value for that in them, even though it might not be a great season for them. But one more thing I wanted to discuss, pretty interesting deal as far as like day before opening day trades go. Because we don't always get blockbuster deals, but we got a pretty interesting one here because the Yankees needed infield help.
Whoa, look at this. I'm sorry. We're doing this, man.
More breaking news?
Breaking news. Press release in our inbox right now. Pirates acquired Joey Bart from the Giants for minor league red-headed pitcher Austin Strickland. All right. Sorry to interrupt you, but that's 2 weeks in a row. All right. We got to start Tuesday night recording sessions with Dara and Steve. That's when the news breaks. So,
all right, Joey Bart. So Joey Bart, yeah, let's pivot to that, and then we'll get to the other one, the other trade later.
We're talking about getting, you know, notable trades or whatever, like, and this, I don't think Joey Bart is necessarily the notable trade that he would have been a couple of years ago, but he's still a name. Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah, he's a name. He was what second overall pick?
Second overall pick, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so he was like a notable prospect coming up
for a while,
but then just never really hit at the big league level. So he just sort of was riding the optional assignment carousel for a long time, and was finally out of options this year. But so, what do you think? What are you? We talked about Bart a little bit before we hit the record button.
We
why don't you
not
give me your thoughts?
That he would be traded while we were talking.
So we knew he was in DFA limbo, so.
Yes, yeah. But, okay, so first off, the Pirates acquiring him is interesting because of the catching depth that organization has. Now, they're going to be without Andy Rodriguez all season after he had UCL surgery. But when he's back, I mean, you're going to suddenly have Joey Bart and Andy Rodriguez and Henry Davis all on the same roster. So that's interesting in and of itself. For now, since he's out of options, you know, you imagine he's going to be the guy backing up Henry Davis. I think it's interesting too. I've been asked a lot since Bart was designated for assignment, you know, what's his value? Can we get, you know, so and so? And I kind of like my answer and my thought process has continually been like the trade is going to be underwhelming for Giants fans. It's not the value isn't there. You have to assume that the Giants tried to trade him all spring and really in the offseason, probably since they traded Tom Murphy. Interest in him has not been strong. I think the perception of a lot of fans have of him as a former number two overall pick and top, you know, 30 prospect or whatever in the game no longer like gels with the reality. And, you know, to that point, you know, the Pirates sent a minor league right-hander named Austin Strickland, who has yet to throw a professional pitch and was their eighth round pick last summer. So this, you know, they traded a guy who was taken 227th overall and signed a bonus just under 200,000. And that's going to be the return that the Giants are getting. It's not great, but it kind of speaks to the manner in which, you know, Bart has kind of backed himself into a corner here. He doesn't have options. He can't be sent down. He hasn't hit well at all in the big leagues. I don't think anybody like doubts that he can play the position well, but the offense just has not been there in parts of four big league seasons now. And also he hasn't really hit much even in AAA over the past 3 years. So, or just, I mean, in any of his AAA stints, he hasn't been a great hitter at the top minor league level. So it's obviously not the outcome you ever want as a, you know, an organization. You take a player in, you know, top five in the draft or whatever, and he just never really pans out, and you kind of end up biting the bullet, designating him and trading him for a negligible return. It's interesting, if only just because the prospect that he once was, and you know, that he's going to a team who wants everyone's healthy, and he could find himself right back in a similar spot where he's the number three catcher on the depth chart and he's out of options. And what do you do then?
Yeah, it's a just the fact that he's out of options is a really tricky spot for him, because he needs to be on a roster somewhere. So yeah, so for the Pirates, for now, he has, they can fit him on there. But yeah, when Grandal is back, Rodriguez
true,
next
year. I didn't even mention Grandal. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, Grandal is, I don't even know what his timeline is off the top of my head, but I think it's just a few weeks or something.
Yeah, like, it's not, he's not out months or anything like that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I mean, I guess the Pirates, they have little to lose, because it's a situation where you put him on the roster, and if he has a good couple weeks and hits a few home runs, then you can probably flip him for more than what you gave away, maybe.
Maybe.
Not substantially, but if he does anything to improve his trade value, then sure, why not? But I guess the question is, because they have Andrew McCutchen in their DH spot most of the time. Mm-hmm. So is there a way to roster three catchers if they have Davis and Bart and Grandal all healthy at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, Davis played a lot of outfield last, almost exclusively outfield in the majors last year, but now they have Michael A. Taylor in center, and you have Brian Reynolds and Jack Sawinski in the corners, and you're not going to really bench any of those guys. So
I also don't think they would want to move Davis from behind the plate now.
Yeah, you got to find out what you have, like, with him as a catcher, you know, and see if he can be that guy, especially with Rodriguez out. It's like, this is the time to see what you have with him defensively behind the plate, because the bat has never been in question as much as the glove. So,
All right. Well, there you go. Joey Bart finds a new home. The other trade that we were about to talk about before getting interrupted by Joey Bart was the Yankees.
So rude, Joey.
Very rude. The Yankees needed some infield help, because they came into spring, I think basically their plan was, if any infielder gets injured, then Oswald Peraza will take their spot. But then Oswald Peraza got hurt, and then DJ LeMahieu got hurt. So they were in desperate need of an infielder. So we got a three-team trade on the cusp of opening day. So the Yankees got John Birdie from the Marlins. They sent out catcher Ben Rortvedt to the Rays. And then the Marlins got prospects John Cruz from the Yankees and Shane Sasaki from the Rays. So three different angles we could look at this. I guess let's start with the Yankees. John Birdie to the Yankees. He's a nice fit there.
Yes, I like John Birdie a lot as a player. He's not, you know, a superstar, obviously, and he's kind of a late bloomer. He's already in his mid-30s, but he can play all over the diamond. He's a good, contact-oriented bat with plenty of speed, who has some experience in the outfield, lots of experience at second, third, and short, good defense at those a lot of those infield spots. And in terms, you know, for the Yankees, yeah, they have the 110% tax. So I can't remember exactly what it came out to, like around $7 million for them, because he's making 3.6. So it's a little more than $7 million, I think, for them. But relative to the Yankees payroll and their financial, you know, capacity, that's not all that much. The $7-something million is probably more digestible for the Yankees than the 3.6 was for the Marlins. And they have control over him this year and next, and he can fill a lot of needs for them. You know, their bench right now, they're carrying Jamai Jones on the bench, and maybe he'll, you know, work out and kind of break out there a little bit, but he's a guy who's bounced around the league right now a lot and never really found that success since his own prospect days. And when they get a little bit healthier and you get LeMahieu back and you get Peraza back, this I think kind of pushes Jamai Jones out of that equation. But John Birdie is somebody who's going to be, you know, locked in there for the next, you know, presumably through the end of the 2025 season. And just a really good kind of, he's kind of that scrappy utility guy that fans just wind up loving, you know, like he's going to dive around and his uniform's always going to be dirty and he's going to, you know, just kind of grind and grit his way through his career. And so I think it makes a lot of sense for the Yankees. You know, they gave up John Cruz is a decent prospect, outfield prospect for them. But he's 18 years old, years away from the majors. They're obviously, you know, committed to trying to win this season. And Birdie just gives them insurance at a lot of different positions and gives them a really nice, really versatile piece to just kind of stash on the bench if they are able to get the full starting lineup, you know, back to full strength. He's just a really nice, nice kind of luxury for them to have that they haven't necessarily had. That consummate utility guy, I feel like in the past few years, they tried it with Marwin Gonzalez and a few others and it hasn't really worked out. So I think it's a good move for them.
I root so hard for Birdie for all the reasons you mentioned. Like he came up as a Blue Jays prospect and I was following him as a Torontonian and you know, he got called up for the first time in 2018, like September 26th or something like that, like the very end of the season. And it just felt like they were like rewarding him for his, you know, years of grinding away in the minors of being like, hey, we'll let you come up to the show for a few games. And, you know, it was a lost season for the Jays. And I thought that was going to be it. They'd give him like the most cup of coffee type thing. And then, that would be gone. But he's amazingly managed to carve out a career since then, just like grinding away, stealing bases, like you mentioned, playing good defense. It's great. It's awesome to see. Now he's made himself millions of dollars in the process. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what it like for the Marlins? I mean, it's a really they're in a weird position because they, you know, made the playoffs last year, but they're also kind of like it feels like they're rebuilding, even though they just made the playoffs. They're just kind of like giving pieces away to save a couple of bucks and get some prospects. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like they acquired several utility types or multiple utility types this offseason, you know, Vidal Brujan and Nick Gordon, who are obviously younger. But I don't know that you would say you can expect more out of either than you would have out of a year of Birdie, and Birdie wasn't particularly expensive. Like I know $3.6 million for the Marlins is more than it is for most teams. But it was pretty affordable. He's really popular with the fan base. And it's like you said, it's a longer term move, for a team that, you feel like coming off the playoffs last year and everything. And you look at some of the moves they made, getting Jake Berger at last year's deadline, and they have Jazz Chisholm in the middle of that lineup, and they just got Luis Arraez last offseason. And like, there's all these moves that they've made, picking up Jesus Luzardo a couple of years ago. They're making these moves kind of like to signify, hey, we're a win now team, and they make the playoffs. And then there's all the turnover atop the front office with Kim Ng, declining her end of the mutual option as the general manager, and the Marlins then bringing in Peter Bendix, who had been the Rays general manager, as their new president of baseball operations. And it just feels like Bendix and Ng didn't have maybe the same vision of where the team is currently at. So you get this weird dynamic of the past, year and a half of trades leading into this offseason and really free agent moves leading into this offseason was all kind of geared toward we're gonna win right now. And now it's more let's take a step back. They didn't really spend anything all offseason. They late in the winter threw a few million dollars at Tim Anderson. It's kind of like a bounce back guy. But that's also a move that you would see a rebuilding team make. So I think they're kind of just in the spot where they say like, hey, if this group gets us to the playoffs, then great. But it'll be fascinating for me if the Marlins are a 500 team kind of on the periphery of the wild card race and I know they're 0-5 to start the season. So that's a taller task now. But if they're kind of like within arm's reach of the wild card picture at the deadline, what do you do then as the new, first year president of baseball operations who has taken a more cautious approach to like what this team's identity is? Do you kind of deviate and say, okay, well, hey, like let's add some pieces, or do you kind of stick to this like plan that you had in the offseason, which was clearly I don't think that, you know, either ownership doesn't think or the front office doesn't think that like it, this is a group that we need to like be all out investing in right now. So it'll be interesting to see how they navigate the deadline as they get closer. As far as the return itself, like it seems fine. They got two decent prospects who will probably slide in. I'm sure they probably have slid into the mid range of the Marlins kind of, you know, top 20, top 30 prospects. And Sasaki's not that far off from the majors and as a guy who, you know, through range and speed and defense and probably can work his way into at least being, you know, a fourth outfielder. But it's not an amazing return for Birdie either.
All right. And the Rays also got a catcher, which I don't know if we need to say too much about that because they needed a catcher. And
speaking of out of options catchers like Joey Bart. Yeah. Ben Roethlisberger wasn't going to make the Yankees roster behind the catchers that they have. And so Trevino and Austin Wells, and they couldn't send him down. So they found somebody who loves themselves a defense first catcher, which the Rays do. Mm-hmm. The Rays could have some real rough production behind the plate this year with Rene Pinto and Ben Roethlisberger. But I mean, those two guys will probably play the heck out of some defense for them. And I doubt the pitchers will complain about having them behind the plate. So
those giant Roethlisberger biceps have to produce some offense at some point.
If you have not seen Ben Roethlisberger's biceps, like when this is a weird thing to tell our reader or our listeners and readers, whatever to do. But I mean, it is like, if this whole baseball thing doesn't work out, you know, there's some, you know, bodybuilding circuit or pro wrestling future for him. He is just like a specimen of a human being. So guy is jacked out of his mind. So, which you'd think he should have more power than, but that just goes to show you, it's not all just about, you know, pure raw muscle.
All right. Well, let's get to your questions. We got a question here from Jimmy who asks, let's say it's trade deadline time and the Diamondbacks are basically a long shot to make the playoffs and want to dump payroll. Do you think there could be a reunion for Jordan Montgomery to be traded to Texas? The contract is right with the option, or does he have a no trade clause?
There's not a no trade clause in there, but I also just like, I feel like if the Rangers were going to do this, like on this contract, they would have just given him the contract that the D-backs did. It was 1 year, $25 million. Like it got down to the point where you could take almost any team and say, like, this is something that they probably could do. And the Rangers still didn't see fit to do it. And you're going to look ahead to the second half of the Rangers. They're hoping that Jacob deGrom and Max Scherzer and Tyler Mahle are all going to be coming off the injured list. And it's just maybe if the Diamondbacks, you know, include some money to pay it down, but it sure seems like for the Rangers, this price point just wasn't one that ownership was willing to go to with all the questions about their television contract status and the bankruptcy filings at Diamond Sports Group, who own Bally Sports. It doesn't seem like this was ever, and we talked about it last week, you know, Evan Grant from the Dallas Morning News is one of their, you know, longest tenured, and probably their longest, you know, beat writer there and well-informed beat guy, kind of just spent all off season just saying it's not going to happen. Like, no matter how much you see national media, like connect the Rangers to Montgomery, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And lo and behold, it got down to the point where it's, you know, a pretty reasonably priced 1 year deal and it still didn't happen. So I understand the affection that Rangers fans have for Montgomery, and maybe next year, if he, you know, turns down that player option and goes out to market, then maybe there's a situation where they bring him back and the, you know, the financial outlook is better. But as for a trade, that's tough. And that doesn't, I mean, he's got the player option too, and trading players with player options is always tough because any team acquiring that guy knows, like, if he pitches well, we have him for 2 months, and if he gets hurt, then we're stuck with, you know, a second year that we probably don't want. So the player options and opt-outs always complicate trade proceedings as well.
All right. The next question is from Ron, who asks, are international free agents eligible for extensions right away, or is there a certain waiting period? I ask this because of the impending Roki Sasaki situation. Could he sign with a major league team next year and play that first year for peanuts, knowing that he has a handshake mega deal agreement in place that kicks in the following year? So just for context, Roki Sasaki is an excellent pitcher in Japan, but he's only, I think he's only like 22 right now. Does that sound right to you, Steve?
We're going to look it up to be sure, but yes, it does. He might be 20. Yeah, he's 22 now. He'll be 23 in the offseason.
Yeah, so he'll be considered an amateur until he's 25, which means
that he needs to be 25 years old and have 6 years of experience in a foreign professional league. So, yeah.
Yeah, so he... This was similar to when Shohei Ohtani came over, where it's part of the international bonus pool system, where each team has a limit per year. It's you know, between like $4 and $7 million, depending on basically the poor teams get more and the rich teams get less. So that means he couldn't get more than a couple of million bucks, in contrast to, you know, like we saw with Yamamoto, who just came over after his 25th birthday, and he got $325 million. So it's a massive difference. Yeah. So to Ron's question, he's sort of asking if Sasaki can like game the system somehow.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about this after Ohtani originally signed. I think I don't remember his exact bonus offhand, but it was in the mid 2 millions, like 2.5 or $2.56 million, something like that. And there was kind of this question of, okay, at what point can the Angels, if they want to, like realistically say, now we're going to extend you, and it no longer kind of falls under the purview of the international free agent guidelines. I don't know if a firm deadline or resolution was ever reached, but I mean, there's specific language in collective bargaining agreements, like kind of giving Rob Manfred, MLB's commissioner, like, you know, there are like basically authority to say, like, if something is like brazenly, like, you know, circumventing a rule that's in place like that, like the league can step in. It would be a gray area to try to figure out like when Sasaki could reasonably, you know, be a candidate for an extension. Obviously, if they sign him for, you know, whoever signs him for a $4.5 million bonus in December, and then February rolls around and he signs a, you know, 12-year extension, like that's not going to pass muster. But if it's 2 years after he signed, you know, that smallish bonus, I don't know. It's an interesting question. It's one that will be hotly debated and discussed next offseason, I'm sure, as it was with Ohtani when he was a free agent and then shortly after he signed with the Angels. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no set deadline, but I do think, you know, teams are going to be wary of kind of trying to pull something off that draws the ire of Major League Baseball and makes the commissioner's office feel as though respect was not paid to the rules that were collectively bargained.
I also think that, there's no way to know what Sasaki actually wants, but you know, like what we saw with Ohtani is like he came over about the same age that Sasaki is now, I think, you know, for his age 23 season, and he never signed an extension. He hit free agency at the age of 29 or 30 or whatever Ohtani is now, and that's when he got his mega deal. So I think it would be just different. I imagine Sasaki would be, he probably wants to come next winter so that he is hitting free agency like around that peak time where he is 29, 30 to sign the big deal then. So he probably doesn't want to sign the mega contract now, I would guess, because it'll be somewhat limited. I mean, Yamamoto shows that teams are willing to pay big bucks for guys who are unproven, but Sasaki's even less proven because he hasn't even thrown 130 innings in a season yet. He got to 129 and a third in 2022 and then was capped out at 91 last year. So I feel like obviously he could throw 200 innings here in 2024 and like totally change this narrative. But if he doesn't have the same sort of track record as Yamamoto, I don't know if teams would be like falling over themselves to sign him the same way that they were with Yamamoto, even though his results have been amazing on a rate basis. I don't know. Would he, because, you know, Ohtani when he came over, there was all this hype about him, but there was also a lot of skepticism about, you know, nobody's ever done this two-way thing before, so can this kid actually do it? And he took his time, proved it, and then got the largest contract in MLB history after he had already, you know, silenced all the doubts. So, like, with Sasaki, would he want to lock himself up right away, or would he want to come over for a couple of years, establish his bona fides, and then put pen to paper?
Yeah, it's we're obviously just kind of sitting here guessing at, like, you know, an individual player's motivations and everything. But, like, if his interest was to just get paid as much as possible in his early 20s or mid 20s, he could just wait two more years and, you know, dominate in Japan and then come over like Yamamoto did as a 25-year-old and say, okay, like, and if he, you know, continues on the trajectory that he's on right now and adds some more durability and some more, you know, workload to the equation, point at Yamamoto's contract and say, I would like to be that. The fact that he is kind of, if he does come over next offseason, he's kind of, you know, waving off the idea of signing a mega contract that's not that far out of reach for him, which seems like a big bet on himself right away. And so maybe that signifies that this is a guy who will be fine going year to year following the Ohtani path. And then if he does hit major league free agency as a, you know, 27 or 28 year old ace, whatever it'll be, then yeah, you might have some truly outrageous numbers waiting for him. So to the spirit of the question, I think you'd have to be probably a couple years out from the original signing bonus to kind of, that's just like a gut feeling, I guess. But like, I think even 1 year after he signs to put that huge extension down, I don't know. I feel like you run the risk of, you know, people kind of saying, hey, this was always in place from the get-go. You know, it's a blatant circumvention of the rules. And then you're going to have a good bit of controversy surrounding that.
Yeah, I think if a team was to give Sasaki something like the Jackson Chourio type deal, because he, you know, sometimes players do sign big extensions before they make their debut, like Chourio did, and he got, I think it was like $82 million over 8 years, plus a couple of club options, then the team could say, well, this is, you know, within precedence, and it's not an outrageous deal. It's actually like pretty close to whatever, but like Sasaki wouldn't want to sign that deal.
No,
because him signing an 8 year deal would take him into his early 30s, and then the options would kind of take him into his mid 30s. So, but yeah, I think the answer to Ron's question is there's no strict rule, but you have to kind of pass some sort of smell test, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, one more question here from Wilson, who wants to know, is there a particular reason that you can't trade a draft pick in Major League Baseball the same way you can in leagues like the NFL? I know there is a system in place for trading competitive balance picks, but just normal picks. I ask because I am a Mets fan and a Gators fan, and it hurts that Jack Caglione probably isn't going to fall to number 18.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording as well. And I think, you know, your point was a good one, that it was always kind of intended as a competitive measure. Like whenever this has been discussed, it's, well, we don't want the big market clubs to sell off all their draft picks to the small market teams or vice versa. And we need to keep a level playing field, and we don't want tanking teams and all this, but teams do that anyway. Like, you know, like instead of trading off like all of their draft picks and trading to stockpile as many draft picks as they can, they just stockpile as many prospects as they can. They gut their roster of all the major league players they have. They tank in the standings and get high draft picks and get as many prospects as they can and try to follow that Astros Cubs blueprint from the middle of last decade. So I think teams should be allowed to trade draft picks. I think it would make things more interesting. I think it certainly would add more intrigue to the draft for a lot of fans. And I know that's something that that Major League Baseball has, you know, kind of moved the draft up toward the All-Star break, and they really want to like make it a bigger spectacle and a bigger event. And I mean, letting teams trade draft picks would certainly get more eyes on it. It would open up a lot more just avenues for teams to be creative insofar as, you know, preventing tanking. Teams have been tanking hard for more than a decade now, even though they can't trade draft picks. So you could say maybe it'll make it worse, but I don't know. I think it's something that eventually should be looked at by the union and by the league and worked into a CBA at some point. I'm for it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I have no moral objection to it. I've seen other people point out, though, that the difficulty in getting it into the CBA is that whenever the league and the players sit down to carve out a new CBA, they have bigger priorities.
Yeah.
They have all this stuff to talk about with, arbitration and the competitive balance thresholds and all these kind of like big financial issues that affect the game. And it's never been a big enough priority for either side to really come to the table to be changed. But it seems like if it did, I don't really know if anybody would really stand in the way at this point. Like, I don't, like, whatever anti-tanking concerns the league or the players have had in the past, I don't know if they would stand in the way of it getting changed at this point. But it just has to be important enough to get to the table. Well, that's all the time that we have for this week. Just quickly before we go, I want to say that next week we're going to do like a Megapod off-season roundup thing with you, Steve, and Anthony and Tim Durkas as well. Because the four of us sat down together at the start of the off-season and sort of talked about our expectations, and then it didn't go the way that we expected.
And did not.
So we'll talk about exactly what we screwed up and, what we learned. And, it'll be a good chat. So check that out. But thanks for hanging out with me this time, Steve.
Yeah, happy to be back for the three-peat, as you so eloquently put it. And looking forward to getting all four of us together next week. It was a lot of fun last time when we took the time to get all four of us together and kind of do an extra long podcast. And, we'll do some of that next week. So should be fun. Look out for it, everyone.
All right, let's do that. Baseball is back. So check out MLBTradeRumors.com. And if you sign up for that front office package, it gets rid of the ads and you get extra stuff in your email and you can use the contract tracker and it's pretty cool. But like I said, we'll be back next week with a Megapod.
Megapod!
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.